This is a talk from bethinking.org, which is UCCF's apologetic website. Apologetics is basically two things. It's the communication and the defense of the Christian gospel. So visit bethinking.org soon, and make sure you sign up as a bethinker to hear all about bethinking.org's latest releases. I feel light
in your arms. Over the past 20 years, a revolution has been taking place in Western culture. This is not a political revolution, but an intellectual revolution marked by the introduction of what we termed politically correct thought. One of the effects of this revolution in the field of literary studies is that the concept of canon is no longer taken for granted. And not so long ago when I was in university, there were a certain set of assumptions that undergirded a liberal arts education. Certain assumptions as to what constituted literary art and what did not. And although literature remained difficult to define back then, and remains difficult to define now and always will be, at least there was some kind of prevailing consensus 15, 20 years ago as to what constituted literature. The classics were well known. Chaucer, Shakespeare, Donne, Spenser, Blake, Wordsworth, Dickens, James Joyce, Ezra Pound, the classics. But coming into the 1990s, there came a point where the canon of the classics was not so clear-cut. Those dissenting from the classical tradition had raised questions. And suddenly, it was not particularly clear why one text should be privileged over another. In the UK, here in the UK and in the States, programmatic claims to what defined literature with a capital L came to be viewed with suspicion. Do not claims for high literature, after all, stem from a certain rather narrow elitist ideological perspective? Are not the reading and teaching of capital L literature nothing less than the perpetuation of certain systemic sin, certain classist, racist, and sexist set of values? Suddenly, the traditionalists among us could no longer rest comfortably with our cherished works. The classics had to be defended. The canon, if you'll excuse the pun, was under fire. In the field of biblical studies, a parallel phenomenon has been taking place in regards to what we call the New Testament canon, and I'm going to limit my talk to the New Testament canon. There's so much to say on canon. You probably do 3 or 4 lectures on canon, so I hope what I have to say tonight is relevant to what is on your mind. By New Testament canon, of course, I mean the books, 27 books ranging from Matthew to Revelation that comprise our New Testament. Even if this questioning of canon has been taking place for centuries, and in this respect, the attack on New Testament canon is not new, but has been going back to early Enlightenment, it's worth mentioning that today the heat of the fire of the fire on canon is more intense than ever. Just there are certain movements within literary criticism that have begun to call into question the value of reading dead white poets, so there too are certain theological tendencies that call into question, make us wonder aloud, in fact, more loudly than ever, why the Christian church pays heed to the dead, probably not so white, apostles of the New Testament era. This evening, it's my intention to discuss and defend the canon. We'll leave the literary canons for another speaker who knows what he or she is talking about. In particular, I would like to explore, time permitting, 2 issues. First, I'd like to provide an overview, selective overview of biblical scholarship on canon, with a special focus on contemporary calls for an alternative canon or a reconfiguring of the canon. Where are we today? And what theological or intellectual forces have brought us to this point? Second, I want to explore the case for a New Testament canon. Is canon a sociological construct, a mechanism of control, as some have suggested, wielded and sustained by a privileged religious elite, or are there other factors? And if so, what are they? What are the criteria by which the early church decided what made the final cut? The history of canon research, part 1. The best place to begin when describing the modern history of research into the canon is with Johann Salama Selmler. Semler, prolific author, wrote over 100 volumes in his prolific career, none more significant than his Abhandlung von freier Untersuchung des Kanons, treatise on the free investigation of the canon, published between 1771 and 1775. On the basis of this research, Semler challenged the age-old wisdom, the age-old conviction that the early church had accepted the canon with one heart and one mind. For Semler, the path to canon was a path of conflict, tactic, political maneuvering, and ecclesiastical intrigue. Moreover, Semler said, the New Testament authors never intended their works to serve as a theological norm for the churches. The early collection of books was simply a list of useful books in the worship. Only later did this list become canonized. If God's word was to be found at all in the New Testament, according to Semler, it was found within the New Testament, but it was not to be co-identified with the New Testament. Now, writing 60 years later, F.C. Bauer developed the notions of Semler, using the Hegelian categories of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. Bauer envisaged the early church as a movement swirling between the competing factions of the Hellenistic wing of the church, which was represented by the Apostle Paul, and the Jewish wing of the church, which was represented by Peter. This taxonomy, the division of the early church between the Hellenistic wing and the Jewish wing, is somewhat outdated, although it still influences, this dichotomy still plays a role in current New Testament study. At any rate, it is noteworthy that for Bauer, as for Semler, the history of the early church was, in short, a history of conflict. For Bauer, the goal of all historical critical reflection on the New Testament was to assess the nature of the true canon, which is an interesting maneuver. In other words, the role of tradition was for Bauer negligible or non-existent. The science of historical criticism was to define for the church what would be the true canon. Now, this brings us up to the end of the 19th century, where two giants of canonical research emerge. The first was Adolf von Harnack, who at the close of the 1880s wrote the Handbook on Dogmatic History. Von Harnack is a giant in the field, but there was one man, only one man according to Harnack, whose criticism he feared, and that was Lutheran theologian Theodor Zahn. Zahn published around the same time his History of the New Testament. Harnack stressed two figures or movements in particular. The first figure was Marcion. Marcion was a wealthy shipowner who lived around what we now call the Black Sea. And according to Marcion, the Old Testament handed down in the church was totally out of keeping with the New Testament message with the Christian emphasis on love. Marcion believed that Christianity was something totally new, totally discontinuity with that which was contained in the Old Testament, and that the God of the Old Testament was not true God at all, but a demiurge, that is, the creator God of Gnosticism. Thus, Marcion set about creating a new Testament, splicing out all the parts of the Old Testament that he could find, which is difficult to do. If you know your New Testament well, you know that it's permeated with the Old Testament. But Marcion set about the task, and what did he come up with? He came up with an edited version of Luke, 10 of Paul's epistles, removing all the pastoral epistles, although perhaps the case may be made that Marcion didn't know about the pastoral epistles at all. And Marcion did this sometime in the middle of the 2nd century. According to Harnack, this was one of the events in history that set in motion the development of the Christian canon. Why? Because the Christians said, well, we need to respond to Marcion. He is mucking about with our canon. But the other important factor for Harnack, and even more decisive according to him, was the development of Montanism. In the 170s, in the hills of Phrygia, one Montanist, joined by two women, Prisca and Maximilla, claimed to be inspired by the Paraclete, that is the Holy Spirit, and prophesied the near coming of the Lord. This sect emphasized prophecy, asceticism, and the power of the Holy Spirit. Some of those I like, some of those I'm okay on. The most famous of Montanists, however, was not Montanus himself, but Tertullian, who later in life converted to Montanism. At any rate, Harnack claimed that the Montanists issued a number of books for which they claimed verbal inspiration. The problem is, this cannot entirely be proven from the evidence. At any rate, Harnack argues that the Christian church at the end of the second century, was just beginning to have a notion of canon and just beginning seriously to make decisions about what was to be included in the authoritative writings. Given the developments in Phrygia, Montanism, which was spreading very quickly throughout the Mediterranean world, it was time to consider closing the canon. Thus, Harnack puts the formation of the canon at the end of the second century. Zahn, on the other hand, thought otherwise. Judging by his study of the quotations of the early church fathers, Zahn saw the New Testament writings as taking on authoritative and normative status very quickly within the early church. Zahn sees the canon closing, well, not closing, but developing as early as the end of the first century. Now, of course, part of the problem in this debate, and you might have picked up on this already, is that Harnack and Zahn are working with two different definitions, two different conceptions of canon. Zahn sees the canon as a process of collection, augmentation, and growth. In other words, the slow, steady development of a corpus of writings. Harnack, on the other hand, saw the New Testament canon as a result of delimitation and exclusion. In other words, canonizing means picking things out rather than pulling things together. Consequently, Zahn's concept of the canon was less strict than Harnack's, and Zahn's dates for the canon earlier than Harnack's. But this brings us to a good point to define exactly what we mean by canonical, because both Zahn and Harnack were right in their own way. When we talk about the development of the New Testament canon, we are talking about a process of growth, what goes in, and delimitation, what does not go in. When we speak of a New Testament canon, therefore, we are talking about, and this is my definition, a closed and exclusive list of books which are held as normative for faith and practice and whose authority is on par with the Old Testament. It's important to raise here at this point as well, and this is where matters become somewhat difficult, that it is entirely possible to have a notion of canon, to think in terms of a closed canon or a set number of books without even using the word canon. Of course, if we want to be extremely conservative, and I don't think anyone would be this conservative in this regard, or liberal, depending on how you look at it, we could suppose that there was no way to prove the notion of canon until the word canon itself was used. This would put us somewhere in the middle of the 4th century, where Athanasius, in his resolutions on the Council of Nicaea, uses the word canon for the first time. Then he uses it again in his 39th festal letter in 367. After that, the term canon begins to take off, at least as applied to New Testament writings. Canon is used plenty of times, going way back into Greek antiquity before then. The same point may be made in reference to Scripture. Do we, as we pursue a history of canon, is the linchpin finding the term Scripture? Is that when we say, aha, this is when they first thought in terms of canon? I don't think this could be proven either, that that's the way to go about it. So, let me just make a point on that. Sometimes the case is made is that there really was no conception of the Trinity until late into the second century, which is really a preposterous argument. Of course, the word Trinity, I think, isn't used until Tertullian, which is the end of the second century. But does that mean there was no conception of the Trinity among the New Testament writers? I don't think so. So, how do we approach this problem of canonicity? We look for instances whereby a certain text is used authoritatively in the fashion as I have described, as normative for faith and practice, and on par with the Old Testament writings. Okay, now Zahn and Harnack set the tone together for all subsequent research on investigation of the canons. Harnack emphasizes the turns, the twists, the lateness of the development of the notion of canon as largely a political process. Zahn was keen to see the New Testament writings as being quickly received as authoritative. For the Lutheran Zahn, what preaches Christ was as apparent as the early church as it was to Luther himself. So you see how they're approaching this from different angles. In many ways, all writing on canon in this century, I mean the 20th century, follows the path that Harnack and Zahn have already laid. But in recent years, the cause of Harnack has received a considerable shot in the arm. In fact, one may group under two separate headings studies that have serious effects, that pose a serious challenge for the canonical writings of the New Testament, the Gospels in particular. One current thrust emphasizes the non-canonical or apocryphal writings the other thrust uses the canonical writings to reconstruct an early stage of Christianity preferable to that reflected in the writings themselves. Now let me begin with instances of the latter. Reconstruction of the pre-canonical, in other words, before Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John, the pre-canonical situation through the canonical writings. Now it's obvious that Christianity existed before our canonical writings. But what is not new is the widespread insistence that the New Testament writings distort what has preceded it. One scholar, Gerd Thiessen, supposes that Paul suppressed the words of Jesus because Paul wanted to suppress Jesus' radical ethical demands, demands that we give up ourselves, give up our home. Paul wanted to bend and suit the gospel to the bourgeois taste of his church, according to Thiessen. Another writer sees Mark as privy to a wide range of oral traditions, but was highly selective, in fact censored most of what Jesus had to say, because he wanted to portray Jesus in a way that was virtually a distortion. To boot, Mark was interested in discrediting other competing tradents, namely the disciples. If you've ever noticed that when you read Mark, Mark seems to be particularly hard on the disciples in his account, more so than Matthew and Luke, and also Jesus' mom, Mary. University of Chicago professor Hans-Dieter Betts, in his book on the Sermon on the Mount, says that the Sermon on the Mount, as we find it in Matthew 5-7, isn't Matthew's creation, nor did Jesus say these words, at least not all of them, but it was a pre-Matthean creation. And Matthew takes this and adds Christological and soteriological elements into it. In other words, heavily changing the material that he had received. Early Christians, according to Betts, and here he's following Bultmann, were interested in the Jesus of history, nor was the pre-Matthean text concerned with salvation as such. Matthew, so the story goes, pirated pre-existing material and conformed it to his own particular idiosyncratic taste. Now, finally, we have to talk about Q. How many of you are familiar with Q? Okay. What is Q? Q is a theological construct. In the middle of the 19th century, a theory was developed, and this theory was called the Q theory. Q for Quelle, German meaning source. Now, if you ever read Matthew and Luke together, you notice that Matthew and Luke seem to have a lot of passages in common, and the theory goes on Q that the similarities between Matthew and Luke must mean that there was a source that they both shared, and ever since we've called this source Q. Many scholars, many very good and many evangelical scholars believe in Q. Does Q exist? Well, it sure might. Does it necessarily exist? Is it a necessary inference of the data? Surely not. At any rate, we have Q. Not in our back pocket, but as a construct. No one's ever found a papyrus with Q on it. No one's ever read any of the church fathers and found a reference to anything that looked like Q. But what is going on here? There's a developing confidence, especially in American theology, on the certainty of Q, and not only the certainty of Q and what it looks like, but of the community that comes around Q. Judging by our own reconstruction of Q, and there are many, it appears that the community of Q did not put a high value on the cross or resurrection. In fact, the community of Q, which, okay, remember, pre-exists Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, cross and resurrection did not factor in at all. Therefore, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John added the cross and resurrection. The core of what we call Orthodox Christianity was a late fabrication, foisted in by our gospel writers. Another vein of research that poses a challenge the canonical writings appeals to the extant documents, not just mere reconstructions of the pre-documentary situations. The apocryphal writings, notably the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Peter, you might have heard of Secret Mark, become representative of Christianity antedating in time or spirit what we find in the canonical writings. The canonical New Testament and the apostolic writings of the second century are seen as attempting to suppress strains of Christian thought and behavior that survived only in the Apocrypha, which, according to people like John Dominic Crossan, are earlier and more authentic versions of primitive Christianity. And he's not alone. There's plenty of scholars who believe the same thing. One scholar, Elaine Pagels, has suggested that the canonical accounts of the bodily risen Jesus, who appeared to attesting males, has the political function of justifying a male hierarchy. Some of the Gnostic works did not have the view of a bodily resurrection and accordingly were distrusted by a self-protective hierarchy. So, many of these writers follow the path of Semler, Bauer, and Harnack, suggesting that the canonizing process was not a primarily theological or religious phenomena, as a political ploy. The canon, it is often argued, was a late attempt to secure victory and hegemony of certain writings over against other writings, which did not quite meet up to snuff. And it is thought, no one thought of the synoptic gospels as authoritative until the church said, hey, let's make these gospels authoritative, because we have to do something about Thomas and Peter, and or Gospel of Peter and Secret Mark. So, there is, in other words, an alternative canon developing. One writer talks about the fourth gospel. When he talks about the fourth gospel, he doesn't mean John, he means the Gospel of Thomas. I'm told that last year at Harvard, at one of the Harvard chapel services, Karen King did the reading for the day, but she chose to read out of the Gospel of Mary, to the applause of her colleagues. This is the way that the canon is under fire. Needless to say, these claims issuing from all different quarters of biblical scholarship, again, particularly American, have put those, like myself, holding to the authority of the 27 books on the back foot. I like the expression, on the back foot. You know, we don't have that expression in the States. And what was really good was explaining to someone who's British what that expression means. That's a cricketing term, you know, and that's... He said, what does that mean? He said, it's a cricketing term. But what is someone who believes the Bible to be true and authoritative and canonical, what is someone to do? Well, I want to, for the remainder of the talk, I want to talk about two approaches or two things that we need to consider. One is to look at assumptions. And this is LaBrie talk. Francis Schaeffer was good at going back to the assumptions, especially the assumptions of our dialogue partner. Let us go back to the assumptions. Let us understand the ways in which the New Testament canon is under fire. Let us understand the theological and historical currents that provide the backdrop of New Testament scholarship. I want to talk, there are many ways to talk about this, but I want to pinpoint three ideas or assumptions which provide the background of New Testament canonical studies. In order to understand what people are saying about the canon today, it's a good idea to have ideas to know where they're coming from, even if they don't themselves know always where they're coming from, if you know what I mean. So, let me tell you what the three assumptions are. Now, assumption number one is this. First century Judaism had no notion of a fixed canon. That's assumption number one. First century Judaism had no notion of a fixed canon. Assumption number two. The gospel writers, who were given to far-reaching revision and distortion, wrote their texts simply for the sake of preserving oral tradition. That's a mouthful. Assumption number two, the gospel writers who were given to far-reaching revision and distortion wrote their text simply for the sake of preserving oral tradition. Now, that might sound something like a contradiction, but we can sort that out later. Number three, the early church did not have a clear notion of orthodoxy until the end of the second century. Assumption number three is the early church did not have a clear notion of orthodoxy until the end of the second century. Let's visit each of these assumptions. First century Judaism had no notion of a fixed canon. Now, do you see what difference this would make? Let me ask you, what difference would it make whether or not the Jews had an idea of a canon to this whole discussion of the formation of the New Testament canon?
Old Testament
precludes
its which would take away some of
your carrying over to the New Testament. Yeah, so in other words, how would we place of the New Testament vis-a-vis the Old Testament? It would raise questions like that. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And certainly those issues were raised. That's right. And I think the connector with that, and maybe more what I was thinking of too, is that if there's already an operative notion of canon within Judaism, then it might be natural for the Christians to think in terms of canon of their own writings. But if there was no idea of canon, then why should the Christians invent that? So this is a problem. The current assumption is there was no notion of canon. That the Jews had authoritative writings, but they didn't think of a closed canon And so for the Christians, it is argued, Alaharna, that canon was an afterthought, rather late at that. Well, what do we know about the Hebrew Bible as canon? Since the 1890s, the so-called three-stage theory of canonization of the Hebrew Bible has been the prevailing hypothesis. The idea is that the three parts of the Hebrew Bible, the law, the prophets, and the writings, were given authoritative status at different points in history. The law was given authoritative status in 4th century BCE, the prophets around 200 BCE, and as far as the writings go, they were given status about 100 CE at the Synod of Jamnia. Thus, the full canon was established, according to this theory, at the start of the 2nd century. In recent times, however, it has been argued that this theory can no longer be maintained. And this is not just argued, but commonly accepted. One of the major criticisms is that at the idea of Jamnia, there really never was a synod, as we term a synod. There was no collective agreement, and certainly they never thought or talked in terms of canon. Another point which deserves attention is that it does not do full justice to the early Jewish sources. As we know from a passage from Josephus, and this, in case you're taking notes, is in Contra Apion 1:38-40. And this is what Josephus says, and this is interesting. He's writing in the first century. Although a long time has passed since the time of Artaxerxes, no Jew has ventured to add, to remove, or to change the scriptures by one syllable. Rather, every Jew sees them as the decrees of God, and if not, he's willing to die for them. And then he specifically says this is in relation to the 22 books. To me, that's a rather high view of scripture. If you're willing to die for them, I don't know what higher view you could have. The new situation leaves room for new theories. Roughly speaking, there have been now three prevailing hypotheses that have developed in the last 20 years regarding the Old Testament. Hypothesis number one. In early Judaism, the full canon of the Old Testament, in the sense of a closed one, did not emerge before the 2nd century. And one fellow who holds this, Eugene Ulrich, teaches at Notre Dame, he thinks that Josephus is a blip on the screen. In other words, Josephus is sort of an oddity. Ulrich is a Dead Sea Scrolls scholar, and he thinks very strongly that Dead Sea Scrolls Judaism represents normative Judaism. Anyway, number two. The collection of the books, this is theory number two, the collection of the books of the Hebrew Bible as we know it was established as a closed canon around 150 BCE. And this is the thesis of Roger Beckwith and a layman as well. And Beckwith, I recommend, if you're interested in this topic at all, but the exact title of Beckwith's book escapes me. I think it's The Formation of the Old Testament Canon. It is an excellent, very readable book on Old Testament canon. Very slowly received in critical scholarship, but as it turns out, things are finally swinging around where people are saying, you know, we think Beckwith might be right. Okay, here's theory number three. Theory number three says the formation of the Hebrew canon did take place, at least as far as the Law and the Prophets were concerned, at a very early date, namely around the 5th century when the books were redacted. And here the basic idea is when we see in Judaism rewriting of scriptures, for example, in Chronicles, Book of Chronicles, 1 and 2 Chronicles, is in some ways a rewriting of 1 and 2 Samuel, what that means is that the chronicler already saw his sources as canonical. Okay. Therefore, we have good evidence, per theory number two or three, that by the first century, there indeed was a strong notion of canon for the Jews. Did first century Judaism have a notion of canon? I think at this point most scholars are willing to say yes. We must keep in mind, however, that when the most powerful voices in the Harnack tradition wrote, and the many German scholars, Kampenhausen, who wrote a very influential book on New Testament canon, they assumed that the Jews had no canon until well after the early church. And so that was really the early church who invented this idea of a closed canon. Okay, so it was only natural that when the Christians brought together their own writings, they were only operating with a canon consciousness. That's my point. So, that's the first assumption. Second assumption is that the Gospels were written down for the sake of preserving oral tradition. It's, you know, you can stop me anytime for questions or if I'm unclear. So let me know. Yep. Yeah? Samuel, 1st okay. Samuel, and Kings. Yeah. The basic idea, and we see this all the way down into the rabbinic period, and even in Christianity. I'll digress a little bit. In the 2nd century, we see a phenomena in the Christian church where gospels are harmonized, where Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are taken, and they're woven together. So apparently somebody said, well, they don't really seem to...
You read Matthew and Mark against each other. Let's try to make this a little bit neater.
So there's a tendency to bring them together. We see harmonization in some of the earliest quotes in the 2nd century. And what this is indicative of is the reason why they try to harmonize these Gospels is because they saw them as authoritative. In other words, if it was secular history written by someone who didn't know what they were doing, well, it might not make sense anyway, but because it's the Word of God, there has to be an inner harmony. There has to be a sense about it and a unity about it. Inner hermeneutical unity, but also unity in how it applies to the community. So when we tell the gospel story to people, we have some ways of harmonizing too. Why does it make sense? Because it has to make sense. Why? Because it's the Word of God. Does that help? You don't look convinced. Okay. Well, that's the point. I'm not asking you to go with me on that, but the basic idea is if rabbis quoted a text and exegeted a text, that text was authoritative. It was worth commenting on and exegeting and giving a new living voice to. That's the way the Jews looked at it. Not everyone buys that. I think it's pretty attractive. Okay. Assumption number 2, the Gospels were written down for the sake of preserving oral tradition. There's perhaps no more influential theologian in the 20th century than Rudolf Bultmann. And Bultmann was one of the earliest exponents of what we call form criticism. Form criticism is the art of sifting through the Gospels and identifying material that existed in earlier oral form. And this might consist of short maxims or sayings or clusters of sayings. And Bultmann had a methodology for doing this. Much of what Jesus said was passed down the church, but only some of it made it into the hands of the gospel writers. Certain sayings that we find in the gospels are in certain pericopes or given events. In other words, the gospel writers invented stories simply for the sake of illuminating or illustrating certain sayings. We know very little, according to Bultmann, about the life of Jesus. In fact, Christianity, again, was not interested in the Jesus of history, was interested in, instead, in the Christ of faith. But the words of Jesus were handed down, and some of them made it into the New Testament, according to Bultmann. So, where are we? These things were passed down orally by the faith communities until, after a long process of rehearsal, repetition, expansion, growth, editing, and redaction, and fabrication by some of the gospel writers, the gospel writers can invent whole events and whole sections of sayings using the material handed down to them. So, as the theory goes, for years no one bothered to write down anything about Jesus, also because they expected him to return right away. This is the thought of the imminent second coming. In other words, no one thought of their writings as authoritative because they thought Jesus would be back any time now. There was no sense of handing on tradition to posterity other than oral tradition. But as the first century wore on, the gospel writers felt compelled at some point to reduce the oral traditions into writing. The gospels were, in effect, basically an afterthought, you see. They said, oh, well, we better write this stuff down before we all die and forget what the traditions are. In no sense did the gospel writers see themselves as writing canonical literature. They had no self-consciousness of that. There's certainly nothing inherent in the gospels to require such a high view of their authority. But what if Bultmann is wrong, you see? What if the Gospels are a fair portrayal of the historic events? And what if, rather than being a written record of oral tradition, they were actual reportage of apostles, Matthew and John, or friends of apostles, Mark and Luke?
Now, without going into details of Boltmann's theories of oral transmission, which are now falling into desuetude, thank God, more and more credence is given to alternative theories of transmission which grant the veracity of the contents of the oral process. So, if Boltmann is wrong, then perhaps, the Gospels are not a haphazard attempt to preserve tradition. Instead, can we not say that the Gospels are a self-conscious attempt to lay the groundwork for the Church? Because if Hermann Ritterbach is right, and that's another good little book, it's a very dense read, it's called, bad on titles, the New Testament Scriptures and someone probably here has read it. New Testament Scriptures and Redemptive History, I believe that's what it's called. But he is a Reformed writer from Netherlands. And he talks about the notion of apostle, meaning sent one, implying an authoritative setting down of what someone has said. So when Jesus called apostles and authorized them to write the New Testament, they were recording salvation history from the start with a canonical consciousness. So, indeed, there seems to be much more at stake than the mere preservation of oral traditions in the Gospels. The other thing we have to consider here is how could it be that Jesus did all these miracles and taught what he taught, and no one bothered to write it down? I think that's more incredible than to believe that 40 years later was the first time someone wrote down anything about Jesus. Now, the other question here, which I'm not going to get into, is the dating of the Gospels. We just don't know. There's such a wide range of when the Gospels could be dated. Boltmann would tend to date the writing of the Gospels very late in the first century. Helmut Kester puts the book of Mark in the end of the second century. So, very difficult. Assumption number three.
Where was the tradition of writing down the Septuagint comes from in that?
A certain Scandinavian scholar called Gerhard Hartson, who around him has grown what's called the Scandinavian school of thought on this, says that because Jesus was a rabbi, everyone took notes on what he said, and very close notes. In fact, what we have, according to Gerhard Hartson, in the Gospels are very carefully written notes. That oral tradition played very little role in the Gospels, and you might have a point.
Did the scrolls throw some light on that?
On oral transmission?
Yeah.
How so?
Another record of what was said, what was said, what was said.
In the Jesus tradition? No, no. No, there's no, you can't find Jesus anywhere in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Or Paul, although some people try to find Paul. I think what we have in Boltmann's conception of oral transmission is a very romantic view, where the Church was charismatic and didn't really care. And this goes back to early 20th century German scholarship, where people saw the early Church as a people of the Spirit, not a people of the book. They didn't care about the book, they cared about the charismatic gifts of the Spirit, and the freedom that Christ brought. And so it is, and this goes back to some of the Marcionism in Boltmann himself. In other words, Boltmann was very keen on distancing Christianity away from Judaism, which was very clearly a religion in the book, you see. And Boltmann liked to see Christianity as having nothing to do with the Torah, nothing to do with the books. This certainly affected his thinking. Okay, last assumption is that the early Church did not have a clear notion of orthodoxy. Ooh, I better get going. Until the end of the second century. Around 1935, Walter Bauer wrote a book that has become a watershed in the study of early Christianity, and this book is called Orthodoxy, Heresy, and the Earliest Church. Bauer's thesis was this, that in the early second century, orthodoxy and deviations from orthodoxy, especially Gnosticism, coexisted peacefully side by side, but by the end of the second century, the Orthodox party felt they needed to gain control over those who disagreed with their doctrine. So we have writers like Irenaeus and Tertullian rewriting history, claiming that they went back, their teaching went back to the apostles themselves. And the point basically is this. Well, the winners always get to write the history, you see. And so what the Orthodox people is they just rewritten history. If there was a difference in Gnostic and Orthodox versions of Christianity, Bauer argues, the difference never manifested itself sociologically. In other words, they never broke church over it. The Church never made issues over the bodily resurrection or passion of Christ until the end of the second century. Now, the Bauer thesis has been criticized, and since I'm running out of time, what I like to do is approach the Bauer thesis from my second point, and that is the criterion of canonicity. But let me just wrap up. this first section. When you read Harnack, when you read any of those wishing to privilege certain apocryphal gospels, Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Peter, or Reconstructions, pre-gospel material Q, one of these three assumptions that I mentioned is usually close at hand. It is usually assumed that the early Christians never had a notion of canon, because the Jews never did, and this is just not true. It does not fit the facts, as far as we know. The Gospels were written as a kind of awkward and rather tendentious afterthought, and this also cannot be proven. In fact, I think the evidence shows the reverse. And three, that the church had an undifferentiated plurality of beliefs, where the different versions of the resurrection peacefully coexisted. Whether Jesus rose bodily from the dead or not was not an issue. Well, I believe it was, and I think a close reading of the Church Fathers says it is, and that's why Bauer is being criticized. But let's talk about criterion of canonicity. One way to approach canonicity is to talk about the different factors and why our books that we have are canonical. I'll give you 11 very quickly. New Testament, yeah, very quick. I'm just going to read them. Here are the reasons. Apostolicity, in other words, were they written by an apostle? Age of the document in question, how old is it? The historical likelihood of its contents, or is the account just utterly fantastic? Orthodoxy of the content. The agreement of the text with the Old Testament, that's number 5.
What do you mean by orthodoxy?
I'll come back to that, because that's pretty much the hub of where I'm going. Because orthodoxy, when talking second century, is an anachronism. You really can't use the word orthodoxy faithfully until after Nicaea, but there had to be somebody who believed these things as believers, is what, you know, who did Irenaeus refer to when he talked about the true believers? I think it was what we call orthodoxy, anachronistically or not. Okay, number 6, the edifying nature of the document. Number 7, it's being directed to the church as a whole, Catholicity. 8, clarity and meaningfulness. I heard somebody on the street talking about the Gospel of Thomas the other day. He was a Christian guy. And he said, you know, I just can't make sense of that thing. And I couldn't either. I spent hours with that thing. Number 9, spirituality. Don't ask me what I mean by spirituality. Number 10, acceptance by the church at large. And that was a long process. Certain books took time for universal consent between the Eastern and Western church. Use for the public lessons in the church. Okay, but it has often been observed that these criteria are used with striking inconsistency. And the 11 I give you are just kind of a collection of different... 11? Sorry, used for public lessons in the church. In other words, did they use them in the worship? For instance, not all writings attributed to an apostle succeeded in being accepted as canonical. Gospel of Peter, Gospel of Thomas may illustrate that. Also, First Clement may be older than the writings of John or Jude, yet First Clement never made it into the canon. Nor will it do to argue that the author of First Clement was not known to be an apostle or an apostle follower, because we don't know who wrote the book of Hebrews. But the book of Hebrews is in the canon. Finally, several writings that were listed on the list of authoritative books did not meet the criteria applied to justify the recognition of these writings. Okay, so what is the criteria? My point is basically this, is in the early church, whatever reasons the early church fathers gave for canonicity, and they named some of these, the basic core assumption or core criteria was that of orthodoxy. The question on everyone's mind when they read any text was, is this orthodox? And I'm just going to give you two examples. Example number one, in the year 200, Serapion, Bishop of Antioch, admonishes congregation not to use the Gospel of Peter. The reasons, because of their ascetic view of the work in question. In other words, the ascetic meaning, when Jesus came, he only appeared to be human, or he took on human form temporarily. He was not really human. When Eusebius writes, in the early 4th century, he distinguishes three categories of books, recognized, disputed, and rejected. Why were books rejected? Because, for Eusebius, they were not orthodox.
Where does the origin of the word orthodox come from? Where would it, how would it be used in those days?
Well, I don't think you would define the word orthodox, but maybe this goes back to the question, what is orthodoxy? And I'll come back to that. I wouldn't think that orthodoxy, I mean, it comes from the Greek word orthos, meaning straight, and doxa, I mean, yeah, what is believed. But what I'm saying is there were certain core ideas about who Jesus was that the church held on to fiercely, and that this is what determined the canon. According to Eusebius, the third category was published by heretics. And he lists Peter, Thomas, Matthias. In other instances, we find the criteria used implicitly in the Meritorian fragment, which is written around 175. The fragment defends the four Gospels against several possible objections. One problem among others is the fact that Gospel accounts of Jesus do not appear to agree. The author deals with this problem by stating that all things in the Gospels are declared by one supreme spirit concerning the Lord's birth, and I'm quoting here, birth, his passion, his resurrection, his converse with his disciples, and his twofold advent. Now, the author fails to explain why he singles out these details for mention. A clue may be found, however, in other passages in the fragment, in which the author strongly opposes Gnosticism and denounces explicitly the teachings of Valentinus and Basilides, two Gnostic teachers. It is reasonable to assume, therefore, that the author's summary of the four Gospels' contents, that is, Jesus' birth, passion, resurrection, was meant to show that Jesus Christ, that his body was real and not apparent, and that he was a divine being who ascended in flesh, who suffered in the flesh, and who rose in the flesh. The author of the Meritorian fragment is combating heresy and appeals to the canonical works as his first line of defense. The standard by which the fragments assess the four Gospels is the criterion of orthodoxy. So, coming back to what is orthodoxy. In this presentation, I've attempted to deal with some of the assumptions of those who question the current New Testament canon. I've also tried to describe some of the historical factors as to why certain texts made it into the canon, others did not. At bottom, the church was concerned with orthodoxy. If the text did not conform to the shape and spirit of apostolic Christianity, they were not included in the canon. Although we have lost Q, if Q ever existed, and a few letters of Paul, Paul's painful letter to the Corinthians, there is a noticeable tendency in early Christianity to accept and preserve those writings whose contents are in agreement with the teachings of earlier generations, and to dismiss those writings that do not meet this criterion of orthodoxy. And you can see this very clearly if you do read some of the apocryphal works, Gospel of Peter, Gospel of Thomas, that there is a different kind of Christology. And the early church well understood this point. It well understood that without incarnation, without bodily resurrection, without eschatological judgment, there can be no redemption. Now, if the leaders of the church in the first century, that is, those who are in a position to control the acceptance of Christian writings and traditions, the leaders who lived between 30 and 70, had the same interest in orthodoxy as the people I've described, and I believe that you can show that they do. I won't go into that. Then it shortly follows that the New Testament, as we have it, forms the best foundation for reconstructing the life and ministry of Jesus and the early church. Can we know where the lines of canon are drawn? Yes, and because we can know the canon, we can know the authoritative message of the life and teaching of Jesus of Nazareth. The question for Christian believer and unbeliever alike is this: what will you do with the message? Thank you.